everyone. I'm Mary O'Brien, an associate at Wilson Sonsini. Thank you for joining our Electronic Gaming Group podcast. I'm thrilled to have you join me as I interview my colleagues and outside subject matter experts to dig into key topics surrounding gaming companies. The information in this podcast is for general information purposes only and may not reflect current law in your jurisdiction. Nothing in this podcast should be taken as legal advice for any individual case or situation, and this information is not intended to create, and receipt or listening does not constitute an attorney-client relationship. No listener of this episode should act or refrain from acting on the basis of any information included in or accessible through this episode without seeking legal or other professional advice from an appropriately licensed professional in the recipient's state, country, or other appropriate jurisdiction. Today I have with me Craig Sherman, a corporate partner in Wilson Sonsini's Seattle office, and Don McGowan, the general counsel at Bungie. Thank you to both of you for joining us today. Don, could you share a little bit about your background and how you ended up at Bungie, including what you do from day to day and what it means to be general counsel?
Sure. I have a bit of an odd Bungie experience. This is my second pass through Bungie, as I describe it, but very few of the Bungie folks do. I got to Bungie in May 2020 was my start date. Before being at Bungie, I was the chief legal officer for Pokemon for 12 years. Prior to being at Pokemon, I was the head lawyer for Microsoft Game Studios. After the Sony deal closed, the Sony acquisition of Bungie, I was having some refreshments with my ex-wife, and she asked me, you know, you have a really strange market niche. Does it scale? And to which I said, I don't think it needs to. I've done everything with this company that I'm probably going to ever do. Take it in and out of large corporations. So that's a big part of the role of the general counsel, is to see a transaction like that coming and to meet up with the good folks that are going to carry you through it and do everything that they can to help you get the benefit of the deal that you've been trying to negotiate. And now we're here and we're a happy part of Sony.
Thank you for sharing that journey, Don. Craig, I was hoping you could also walk through your practice, including what you do for companies and how your relationship with Bungie began.
So I guess I'll start with my career first. I've been a corporate lawyer for about 35 years now. And for the last 28 years or so, I've really focused on representing technology companies, particularly at their earliest stages. So typically, but not always, I get involved at the time of incorporation of the company and work with the company as it scales. So through the first angel financing, through venture financing, through public offerings, through M&A and beyond. And Bungie's a great example of this. Although I didn't start an incorporation, I started shortly after Don finished on the front end of his journey with Bungie when he was still on the Microsoft side. Shortly after Microsoft spun out Bungie as a newly independent company, I was approached by the CFO of Bungie at the time, who was somebody I had worked with at another company before, and he asked whether we'd be willing to work together. That was about 15 years ago. So I've worked with Bungie from the time where it was just a brand new company, freshly spun out of Microsoft and figuring out how to scale as an independent business. Worked with them on their original publishing deal with Activision, and company eventually did raise some outside capital and then finally was acquired by Sony in the deal that Don described. And then post-transaction, even though Bungie is a wholly owned subsidiary of Sony at this point, we continue to work together on multiple issues that come up in the business on a day-to-day basis, including on a call Don and I will be on in 45 minutes.
It's like Godfather 3, Craig. Just when you think you got out, we keep dragging you back in.
Craig, as a high-level introduction for our listeners, could you touch on how an attorney-client relationship is formed?
Sure. What's interesting about attorneys and what makes attorneys kind of unique is that when a potential client has a conversation with a lawyer, that conversation is a privileged conversation, and the lawyer is bound by ethical obligations not to disclose anything that happened in that conversation, regardless of whether a formal engagement is actually created after the fact and an engagement letter is signed. Something that's important for the lawyers to be aware of is something that's important for the potential clients to be aware of. And in many respects, it should give potential clients comfort, because we often have a client that's in a business that's in a highly competitive space, or they've built a technology that's really unique, and they're worried that by having a conversation with a lawyer without engaging the lawyer, they may breach confidentiality. They often will ask us for NDAs. You don't need a lawyer to sign a non-disclosure agreement. Yeah, the fact that Don and I could be disbarred if we disclose something that was disclosed to us in confidence from a potential client prevents lawyers from doing bad things for the most part, at least in this respect.
Don, it sounds like it's pretty easy to begin an attorney-client relationship. However, the true value comes from the success of the relationship. What are some key factors you think people should consider when choosing an attorney to represent their interests?
Well, Craig's dilemma about the creation of the attorney-client privilege is a little bit more attenuated for me because I work for a company. So anybody who thinks I'm going to be their lawyer is kind of dumb. How you get the attorney-client privilege or relationship started, the best way to do it, I've discovered, is to inherit it. I inherited Craig when I got to Bungie. Not that I don't love him. Not that I wouldn't have picked him if I had the choice. But I inherited Craig, which is a common thing that happens for general counsels who come into a company that already has pre-existing relationships. So I'm going to pivot your question slightly into, okay, you know, I had Craig. Why did I keep him? First of all, his boyish good looks and charm. Second of all, his depth of history with the company. It's funny. I was talking to him about this recently because in my mind, Craig was there because, in my mind, Wilson Sonsini was the firm that helped Bungie with the spin-out from Microsoft on the Bungie side. But Craig says he wasn't around for that, and so he just happened to inherit it that way. You get somebody, you talk to them, you find out how much history they have with the company, and you say, okay, this is a person who I better keep around because I'm never going to know this stuff unless I go to somebody who has that level of history. And it's funny because in this environment of law firms and clients today, you find a lot of clients bouncing around a lot. There's an amount of pressure from things like fees and stuff like that, that, you know, I'm going to bring up the four-letter word of fees and just say it. There's pressure that people get from fees to try and move their work from places that it's been for years. And sometimes the fees you're paying are the price you're paying for that repository of history. And you can't look at it as just a dollars and cents question. My suggestion to anybody who's looking to find a firm is go to a firm that's established enough, like Wilson, where the people who are there, especially the ones who are there in the partnership ranks, probably have married for life. And that way, you know they're going to be around 10 years from now when you still want them. I have no doubt in my mind that Craig Sherman is there for Bungie when we need him. Wilson Sonsini has many great attorneys at it. Craig is one of them. I'm going to shut up and give him a chance to tell you some more about why.
Craig, like Don touched on, we know attorneys' fees can be intimidating and discourage companies, especially startups and smaller companies, from seeking legal counsel. However, Don really touched on why companies should invest in good counsel, and I'd love to hear your thoughts about best practices to maximize the value a client can receive from their attorney.
Yeah, you know, it's a great question because a lot of potential clients will just look at the hourly rates and say, oh my goodness, these hourly rates are so high, I can't afford this law firm, and we'll engage with the law firm later. For law firms that work with startups, the ones that are successful know that a client in its first few years should not be spending a substantial portion of their budget on legal fees. It doesn't make sense to spend a lot of money on lawyers. On the other hand, you need to make sure that things are done properly because we often inherit clients that were incorporated by another law firm and then did a first financing, or sometimes worse, a second financing. The law firm that's not experienced in this area, and we spend a tremendous amount of time and unfortunately the client's money fixing mistakes where it's kind of penny wise and pound foolish, that the client may or may not have saved a little bit of money in the short run by using a law firm with a lower hourly rate, but then it ended up in the long run spending a lot more money fixing mistakes. What a lawyer is doing for an early stage company is not rocket science. What the clients are often doing, the clients that we work literally often, is rocket science, but the legal work is relatively straightforward. On the other hand, it's easy to make small mistakes, and those small mistakes can be very problematic. When a company is issuing the stock to its founders, it's the same as the federal government printing dollar bills or, you know, minting pennies. You are creating currency that has real value. And if it's not clear how many shares are actually outstanding because the documentation was not created properly, then it often requires a big fix to go back and make sure things were done right. And sometimes certain problems may not be fixable. And we encounter this all the time. So that's why we strongly prefer to get involved at the earliest stage. We and other firms like us often will do deferral arrangements where the legal fees are not paid until and if the company gets funded. So it really aligns us with the interests of the company, making sure that the company gets funded, because if the company doesn't get funded, we don't get paid. We are aligned with our clients regardless of whether or not we have this kind of deferral arrangement, but those deferral arrangements really do make sure that we're aligned. We all want to make sure that the company gets funded and survives at least until the next financing round. I found often when looking at transactions where, say, we're representing the investors and another law firm that has much lower hourly rates is representing the company, that our fees end up being much lower than the fees of this firm that's supposedly lower priced because of the efficiencies, because this is all we do all day long. And we know what's important and worth fighting about. And there are things in a venture financing or an angel financing that are super important and absolutely worth fighting about. And then there are things that are not worth fighting about. And it's often some of these less experienced, lower priced firms that end up generating much higher legal fees for everybody involved because they fight about everything. They don't know what's important. And you end up having a lot of fights over things that are just not market. And it wastes everybody's time and generates a lot of fees. So it's super important to work with lawyers who really specialize in this area, in part because they will be accommodating, like we will often be on these deferral arrangements. In some cases, for example, on incorporations, we generally do that for a flat fee. And most firms will do that again, to save the client's money early on. For example, our electronic gaming group actually has a program that's dedicated to early stage gaming startups, which we call Nest. Nest offers an array of tools and services, including access to startup tools, alternative fee arrangements, including the deferrals that we just talked about, legal services targeted for gaming startups, coaching and mentorship, corporate governance, IP and commercialization, and much more.
And, you know, we're successful working with a client over the long term if the client grows and is successful and has a Bungie-like exit with Sony. That's where our fees tend to add up, because those are the high-pressured, very intense deals with big New York law firms on the other side and law firms from other countries where there's massive amounts of diligence. And, you know, we have to have a tremendous team to manage the amount of work, whether it's on the transaction, antitrust issues, regulatory issues that come up that create a lot of legal work. And for experienced law firms that work with companies from startup until that liquidity event and beyond, those firms really should be expecting to get most of their fees from the end of the relationship, not from the beginning of the relationship.
Mary, before we keep going, I just want to hop on what Craig said and give a little perspective from the other side also. I find that the best way to get a big legal bill is to start by trying to get a small one. And then there's the old saying that I only want to cry once. And if I got to cry twice, that means I did something wrong. And so the best way to end by spending a lot of money is to start by spending very little. That's an important consideration for folks to keep in mind as they're making their own choices of counsel. I would say, you know, it's funny that Craig mentioned minting pennies. I'm originally from Canada. We don't have pennies there, Craig.
Wait, what are they called?
Phased out the penny. No, Canada phased out the penny about 10 years ago.
Oh, you're kidding. So you start at 5 cents?
Yep. Everything rounds up or down.
Wow. I'm moving to Canada.
I think that's a great thing for folks to keep in mind is, you know, when you want to be penny wise, pound foolish, first of all, you don't want to be that because maybe there's no such thing as pennies anymore. And secondly, you don't want to be that because the pound in that expression isn't a measure of weight. It's a measure of money. And there's only so much money out there when you're just starting up. I have been fortunate enough to have worked in highly capitalized companies. One was called Microsoft. I understand an incredible blessing, especially inside the entertainment business. Knowing that you're going to be able to pay your employees is an incredibly lucky situation to be in. It's folks like Craig that helped us be in that position at Bungie, and I will owe him a debt for the rest of my life because of that.
Better watch out. I may come to collect.
Don, Craig mentioned great points that you touched on further about maximizing the value for clients. What are some key points that you suggest these smaller and startup companies talk to their attorney about?
The one that Craig sort of glossed over a few times is one that I would say that should be a checkpoint for you. When it's time for you to start receiving money or issuing shares of your company, you don't know what you're doing. I don't know what I'm doing, and I've been a lawyer for 25 years, right? Like, I mean, you know, when it came time for us to talk about getting acquired, I mean, I know how to be acquired, but I don't know the mechanics of how to make it work. When you're looking at something, you're like, oh, I know enough to do this. No, you probably just know enough to be dangerous to yourself, if not to somebody else. That is a serious breakpoint you should think about. The second thing that I see with a lot of small companies is they don't properly value the IP that they're creating. A lot of small companies don't make a lot of decisions and leave themselves exposed to not being able to own their own name later on down the road because somebody else in the same industry managed to go out there and trademark their name. That's a great opportunity to think about, okay, well, here's the thing I wish I could have done differently. Get the IP around your company's most important assets. Usually it's your name. Sometimes it's your product and not your name, but usually it's both of those. And so you'll want to get with a lawyer to talk about how best you can do that. I recommend to people that they get with a lawyer early. I obviously, for very self-interested reasons, tend to think that the one of the most important hires a small company makes is its legal counsel, both its law firm and its first lawyer in-house. I would say that when you're making the decision of when you want to hire an in-house lawyer, talk to your law firm. Maybe even see if they'll put somebody on your interview loop, because no one's better at telling you whether or not this person is blowing smoke than somebody who knows what they're talking about. A lot of companies steal their lawyer from their law firm. Don't steal from Wilson Sonsini. Their people are too good. I need them. But certainly, you know, I suspect if I was to ask Craig if he would sit on an interview loop for me, I wouldn't have to ask him twice.
Absolutely. And I do that on a regular basis. I think it really is important.
So I would love to hear from a general counsel position how Bungie determines when it needs to loop in outside counsel such as Wilson Sonsini on a matter. And when you do reach out to your outside counsel, what are you really looking for from them?
So the first one I'll point to is litigation. There is an obligation for companies that companies can't represent themselves in court. I used to be a litigator and I can't go to court anymore. It makes me sad sometimes. But that's a good example of the stuff a company can't do for itself. The second stuff is the stuff I can't do for myself. I mentioned a couple of minutes ago when we were doing the deal, I couldn't have done the deal without our Wilson Sonsini partners. I want to layer into that a little bit more and talk about a bunch of the regulatory nonsense that I, a guy who's practiced for 25 years, didn't know existed. Because Sony's a non-US corporation, stuff relating to acquisition of technology companies by non-US entities, that I was just like, I'm sorry, we have to what? But absolutely, you know, that kind of stuff. And then what you're looking for is a combination of things. First of all, I hate this description, but I have a different use of the term myself. When you're hiring an outside lawyer, you're hiring for fit. I actually have a rule around law firms. When I hire them, obviously, you know, I inherited Craig and his team, and they've never been anything other than exactly where I would expect them to be on this. But I have a rule that says anytime that there is a client team, one of the lawyers who's client facing has to be either a woman or a non-white lawyer, so that then that person will get experience having client-focused work. And one of the things I am looking for when I look for an outside law firm is somebody who shares that value for me, right? And so Jackie Hamilton from your New York office, she's fantastic. One of my favorite people on the earth. Wilson just has a good deep bench of people that Wilson is trying to make into better lawyers and to make the legal profession better by having them. That's the thing that's super important to me. You'll find that a lot of companies, that's super important for them, because we understand that clients can drive the buildup of diversity in the profession a lot easier than anybody else can. Our hiring decisions help this stuff move along in directions that, you know, we want to see. Bungie is a very strong commitment to diversity. I like to phrase it like this. We make consumer entertainment. So we want the whole world to see themselves in our products. And the easiest way to do that is to include people from the whole world in the making of our product. And so that's a perspective that informs me as I think about my outside counsel hiring practices. I know that my Sony colleagues have very similar rules for themselves also. So I think the important thing is what I'm looking for from outside counsel, first of all, is that level of fit. Second of all, is an expertise in a subject matter. And I don't want to say it like, you know, fit comes before subject matter expertise. The two things will usually come hand in glove. The third thing I'll be looking for is that history with the company, if I can possibly get it. And that's the thing that I think a lot of people don't understand the importance of it. And it's why, you know, when I showed up at Bungie, my first thought was, okay, got to meet our outside lawyers, because these are going to be some of the most important people in my next couple of years of my life. Didn't know how important they were going to be, but you don't usually show up in the company and then immediately do a transaction with it. But certainly having that deep level of history has been very helpful for me in a lot of moments.
Craig, flipping it around to be on the attorney side of the relationship, what are some common challenges when it comes to managing your clients, and how do you navigate those challenges successfully?
Yeah, you know, what's really interesting about the legal business is it's not much different than being in a restaurant business. It's a service. We're providing a service, and you've got to take care of your clients. I don't know if either of you have been watching the television show The Bear, which is awesome and highly recommended, but big part of the second season, and hopefully the spoiler alert, I don't think I'm giving away anything big here, but one of the characters goes and works in a Michelin 3-star restaurant and goes in with a bad attitude and comes out recognizing the joy in the work of these people who, frankly, are not very well paid for the amazing work that they do, because they really enjoy taking care of people and providing great service to people, making people happy. Ultimately, a legal business is no different. A law firm is there to take care of the clients, anticipate their needs, and do fabulous work. It means that it's a people business and it's about relationships. And that can be one of the biggest challenges in this job, is that sometimes this doesn't happen too often, but sometimes as a lawyer, you're working with a client who is difficult and doesn't want to be cooperative and follow the advice or even discuss the advice that you're providing. That can be a challenge. Luckily, that doesn't happen too often, but it does happen. Sometimes there are challenges working with lawyers on the other sides of transactions, where the lawyer on the other side of the transaction seems intent on killing the transaction because they can. And the lawyer is kind of stepping beyond the role of a business lawyer in getting something done, but instead is seeking to do the opposite and make sure a deal doesn't happen. And I see that happen a lot. One of the biggest challenges for a lawyer working with earlier stage companies is that understanding the separation between the personal relationship and who your client is. And I often see a lot of lawyers in other firms not really understand and follow the basics of corporate law, which is when you're a corporate lawyer, you represent the entity. You don't represent the people. You don't represent the management team. You also don't represent the investors either. And I certainly have seen lawyers working with startup companies going in one direction or the other, taking the position of the founders, even if that position is adverse to the company, or on the flip side, taking the position of the investors, even if that position is adverse to the company itself. And it's really hard for a lawyer to draw those lines, particularly where there are long-term professional relationships involved. I've had a number of clients that I've worked with for years where at some point the board of directors decided by a overwhelming majority that it was time for either the founding CEO or a hired gun CEO to leave the company or move to a different role. And I have to be involved in those conversations because I represent the company. I don't represent personally the person that I've been building a relationship with sometimes for 10 years or longer. And those have been some of the hardest conversations I've had to be involved with, you know, being counsel of the company and passing along the news that this person needs to find another job. I'm proud that I've been able to maintain a lot of those relationships, and many of the CEOs I've worked with where I've been involved in the conversation with a board member about moving out of the company, they start another company 6 months from now, and we often represent that next company. And they understand because we explain from day one, you know, remember, we represent the company, we don't represent you personally. And we'll tell you when we're crossing a line or when we're approaching a line that we need to be wary of, because at some point I'm going to tell you, and this comes up in M&A transactions. So that can be one of the biggest challenges. But as a lawyer who does this all the time, it's super important to make sure you understand where those lines are and how to follow the rules.
Thank you for that insight, Craig. For both of you, I'd love to hear your thoughts about what role trust plays in the attorney-client relationship. And from both sides, how can you begin to build trust with the other side?
Craig, you go first.
I think the most important thing is transparency. I think it's really important to build a relationship and build a level of trust by always being very clear about what's going on and no hidden agendas. You ideally are going to be working with the individuals of the company for long periods of time. And it takes time and working together to understand how to communicate clearly with each other and be upfront about any issue, whether it's issues that are coming up on the deal that are difficult issues and where interests may be misaligned, and explaining those issues and exploring them up front, or whether it's billing, which we talked about earlier. There are lots of issues that can be challenging for outside counsel and the client and the individuals who work at the client. And to build that trust relationship long term, you just need to communicate clearly and frequently.
So let me pile on that for a minute. And for those of you who are listening, you don't know this because you're only listening. Craig and I can see each other because this is a Teams call. So I wanted to see Craig while I let him answer that question first. Now he showed me his, so I'll show him mine. The role that trust plays in the attorney-client relationship is critically important, all right? You heard me talk earlier about how I inherited Wilson Sonsini. One of the biggest aspects to inheriting your law firm is, okay, you know that firm has history with the company and often has deep history with the executives that you as the new incoming GC may not have yourself, right? Those folks can be very helpful for you in bridging gaps with your current executive team. You know, so that's sort of thing number one. Thing number two, what role does trust play in the relationship between, I'll use names, between Craig and me? Well, I know that if something's going on, I'm going to get the straight answer from Craig. I may not like it. I say to people, you have the right to an answer from me. You don't have the right to like it. You have the right to get the answer. You don't get to choose whether or not you're going to enjoy the answer. That's an unfortunate aspect of our lives, that people sometimes don't like the things we're going to tell them. But you got to know you're going to get the right answer from somebody who isn't afraid. And this is, you know, another reason that I say, never try to save money on the bill unless it's work that you can afford to have get expensive, because what you don't want is people who are desperate to keep that billing coming in, and then they'll tell you anything they think you want to hear. The worst lawyer on earth is the one who tells you what they think you want to hear. The best lawyer on earth is the one who makes the thing you want to hear the right answer, which is a little bit easier in some domains than in other domains, admittedly. But, you know, I know that I can trust the lawyers at Wilson Sonsini, for example, to tell me what I need to know. I may not want to know it, but I don't have the right to want to know it. I have the right to get to know it. And I 100% believe if I send a note over to Craig Sherman saying, hey, can I get a piece of information? He will cause the best person at his firm to provide him with that information. Often it'll be him, not always. And I will get the best information that Wilson Sonsini can provide in the time frame that I need it. And I'm not going to name names here because that's kind of a not cool thing for me to do. But I will tell you, there are competitor firms to Wilson Sonsini who will find ways to give me the information that may not come from the best person at the firm, but comes from the person that I called wants to be the person that talks to me. And that's super not cool when you're on the receiving end of that. And I have only ever thought great things about the people that I've worked with at Wilson. You know, I want to bridge over to one other aspect of this, Mary, which is, you know, as somebody who has been functionally the general counsel in three roles, Bungie, and then previous to that, chief legal officer of Pokemon, and previous to that, head lawyer for Xbox Games, I've had the somewhat strange for a lawyer circumstance of having to move jobs. And one thing about when you're an in-house lawyer and you move jobs is, the second you've made the decision to leave and go somewhere else, I believe you have an obligation at that point to tell your primary point of contact on the company side, hey, I'm leaving, because they need to know, okay, you are on your way out the door, and they need to be able to make the decision, do I still trust the advice I'll get from this person? And so, you know, it's very much a hurry up and get out the door moment. And so I have always optimized for leaving a replacement in place and getting out quickly. I think that's incredibly important. I think that's one thing that law firms can help with as they're traveling through their relationship with the client, is assisting the client, and the client being, you know, the idiot like me, assisting the client to remember, you got to build yourself a bench, because you could just suddenly become unavailable someday, whether it's because you're leaving or, you know, I've had it happen in my case. I had a stroke in 2019. And became unavailable to my company for a month while I was sitting in the ICU. I don't recommend that as a way to take time off. Please don't. Please take your time off in other ways so you don't end up having a stroke on your Peloton. But certainly having a bench of people that you can rely on in those kind of literally life critical moments takes a lot of the stress off you. And, you know, in my case, took a lot of the stress off my wife, too.
Mary, before we move on from this trust issue, there was one thing I realized I wanted to add here. And it's about the relationship between the personal relationship between the lawyer and a general counsel in particular. We often work with companies where we've got the history, as Dom was talking about earlier, and a general counsel doesn't get involved until the company's more mature. When one of our clients hires a general counsel, it's super important for us to build a relationship with that general counsel and be comfortable with the fact that when a company has a general counsel, the role that we had with the management team in the past is going to evolve. And it's really important for us to work effectively with the general counsel and be supportive behind the scenes of the general counsel so the general counsel can be successful. We'll be successful if the general counsel is successful because that's our primary relationship. We're reporting to the general counsel, even if this is the first time the company's had a general counsel. And I have certainly worked with lawyers who will work around a general counsel and view the general counsel as the enemy. And I've also worked with general counsels who view the outside counsel as the enemy because they feel like the outside counsel may be a spy or may not be acting in the best interest of the company. They're acting in their own best interests. And to establish that relationship of trust with the general counsel, once the company has a general counsel, it's just super, super important because you have to be successful together. And neither the outside law firm or the general counsel are going to be successful if they're in a contentious relationship and battling each other.
A relationship you never have with Wilson Sonsini. The key takeaways from that transaction. One, we got taken away by Sony. Two, it worked. I say that also sort of taking from Craig and Craig's partner, Rob Ishii, and John Brust and Jackie and other people that touched this deal commented on some of its unusual aspects. I'll describe them as unusual and say, Bungie has very strong structural guarantees of independence in that deal. And that's a very unusual thing. And I'm very grateful to our friends at Sony for being willing to consider that kind of a relationship with us. We had to think of ways to create and maintain those structural guarantees and to find a way that we on our side could be comfortable and the Sony people on the Sony side could be comfortable with the idea that Bungie is going to run as an independent company. I mean, you know, it's funny, when we started the deal, I would say to people, everybody understands this deal ends with me getting fired, right? Because what usually happens in an M&A transaction is the acquirer comes in and replaces three departments, usually at least two, most often three, legal, finance, and HR, kind of in that order. And I will also say, you know, Craig has heard me use this expression a few times when we were doing the deal. If I was the lawyer for a company that was buying a company, and I found out that the target was coming in with its own legal department, I would be incandescent with rage. And instead, you know, the Sony folks have been very great. And I think credit a lot of that to the great work that the Wilson folks did in finding ways to make this aspect of our existence as painless as possible for them. There is, inside the gaming industry, there are various types of games that, you know, a bunch of distinctions that don't mean anything to anybody else except us. But the easiest one I can think of is, there is the difference between what we call a box product and a game as a service product. And games as a service is like software as a service. Box products is box products, obviously. Box products are a lot more fire and forget. And games as a service involve you having an ongoing relationship with your customers after you sold the product. How they manifest is, think of the difference between a movie and a TV show, right? A movie exists as a discrete self-contained unit sitting on a screen in a theater for anywhere between 1 hour and 40 minutes and now 3 hours and 20 minutes. Whereas a TV series exists, it's consumed, the story unfolds over time, it's expected to unfold over time, new things will happen, etc. And so I draw that as an analogy to how it is inside the legal environment. Is a good relationship with your law firm, you go into it in an environment where it could easily be a fire and forget activity. And how it is when it's a good relationship is it becomes something that unfolds over time. New characters get added, new storylines get added, etc. The Wilson Sonsini folks have provided me with one of the greatest casts of characters I've ever had the pleasure to work with. And I made a movie once, so I feel like I can say that.
Thank you, Don. Flipping it on you, Craig, now that you've heard Don's thoughts, you've had many clients over the years and have seen firsthand what makes or breaks a relationship with a client.
I think it really does come down to those personal relationships. I mean, it's two things. It's personal relationships and it's expertise. But the team has largely been the same other than that over the years. And we've been able mutually to build these relationships where we trust each other. We know the issues that people within the team care about. And it's that history that we have that I think allows us to work together really well because we can shortcut conversations. We don't need to reinvent the wheel all the time. We've been working together long enough that we can not quite complete each other's sentences. We're not married to each other. We just work together and work together very well. We know where sensitive issues are, what's important and what's not important. And so building those relationships is super important. And then it comes down to the expertise. And Don and I have never had a conversation about this topic before, but he talked earlier about how he may call me as kind of the senior relationship partner who's been involved with the company for a long time. But he knows that I may not be the one who's going to have the best answer to that question, that we've got experts within the firm. And that's one of the wonderful things for me about being in a larger full-scale firm that works with companies from the very earliest stages to giant public companies is that somebody, one of our colleagues has experience that's going to be valuable and related. And whether it's an issue of antitrust law, whether it's CFIUS, Committee on Foreign Investment in the U.S., and how a U.S. company can be acquired by a foreign company or take investment from a foreign company, whether it's a specific technology licensing issue, whether it's an employment issue, there's a whole set of issues that a general counsel has to deal with on a regular basis that I, as a corporate generalist, encounter because the clients will call, but I know who within our firm to reach out to and get the expert opinion. Bungie has always been a Delaware company since it's spun out. And we had a lot of unique issues of Delaware law over the years where we've got wonderful partners and associates in our Delaware office who have unique expertise that lawyers in most other firms don't have. And it's really valuable to bring that experience within the firm to bear, the kind of the knowledge of the collective rather than just work with one person. Hopefully Don and Bungie appreciate that. They know that they can reach out to me as their primary point of contact, but I'm in many cases going to find somebody else within the firm who's going to actually provide the right answer.
And I just want to pile onto that slightly. First of all, by saying, Craig, I don't think you know how shocked I was when it came that moment in the deal and I found out y'all actually have a Delaware office. Because the number of firms that don't have a Delaware office that purport to do this work and don't even have a Delaware called lawyer and just like, the person from New York handles this all the time. Like, yeah, but do they really? and then the second thing is, you know, Craig pointed out, usually Wilson Sonsini is going to have somebody that can answer any question for you. And I lean on usually a little bit because, you know, not every firm has somebody who's perfect for everything. One of the biggest challenges for general counsel is we get asked a lot by employees of the company, hey, do you have a person for XYZ? Very rarely is a person who's going to handle a personal legal issue somebody who's going to work at a place like Wilson Sonsini. They might, but usually it's not going to be somebody like that. And so I would say the great thing about Craig and about Wilson is I know that if they don't have a person, they'll tell me they don't have a person. And they'll find me a person, even if it's not a Wilson Sonsini person. I know we're about to end up, so I'm going to bridge that into the last thing that I say, which is one of the things that you need to know is that if you're new to a company, you're going out to hire a law firm, they are going to work you in 1,000 different ways that you don't even see coming. I have never had that feeling from Craig or from anybody I've dealt with at Wilson. I feel like I am always getting the best answer that they have to give me. That is an incredibly good feeling to have. If you get it, hold on to it. If you don't have it, find it. The best piece of advice I can give to anybody is if you can get it, get it. If you can't get it, go looking for it. You deserve to have that kind of a relationship. And also, you're paying them a lot of money. Shut up and listen to when they talk. And so now I'm going to do that for Craig.
I have nothing more to add to that. That was just too good.
Thank you for your time today. Wilson Sonsini advises a wide variety of clients in the gaming industry. If you'd like more information about legal issues arising in the gaming space, please check out the Electronic Gaming Group's website or our newsletter, The Scramble. If you have any questions, please don't hesitate to reach out to any member of our Electronic Gaming Group. Thanks for tuning in, everyone. Thank you.